Chapter 29. We hope our readers will not be alarmed at this rather ominous title. We assure them that we are not about to become political, neither have we the slightest intention of being more prosy than usual, if we can help it. It has occurred to us that a slight sketch of the general aspect of the house, apostrophe and the crowds that resort to it on the night of an important debate would be productive of some amusement. And as we have made some few calls at the aforesaid house in our time, have visited it quite often enough for our purpose, and a great deal too often for our personal peace and comfort, we have determined to attempt the description. Dismissing from our minds, therefore, all that feeling of awe, which vague ideas of breaches of privilege, sergeant-at-arms, heavy denunciations, and still heavier fees, are calculated to awaken, we enter at once into the building, and upon our subject. 4:30, and at 5 the mover of the address will be on his legs, apostrophe as the newspapers announce sometimes by way of novelty, as if speakers were occasionally in the habit of standing on their heads. The members are pouring in, one after the other, in shoals. The few spectators who can obtain standing room in the passages scrutinize them as they pass, with the utmost interest, and the man who can identify a member occasionally becomes a person of great importance. Every now and then you hear earnest whispers of that Sir John Thompson, apostrophe which? Him with the gilt order round his neck? No. That's one of the messengers, that other with the yellow gloves, is Sir John Thompson. Here's Mr. Smith. Lore. Yes, how do you do, sir? He is our new member, how do you do, sir? Mr. Smith stops. Turns round with an air of enchanting urbanity, for the rumor of an intended dissolution has been very extensively circulated this morning, seizes both the hands of his gratified constituent, and, after greeting him with the most enthusiastic warmth, darts into the lobby with an extraordinary display of ardor in the public cause, leaving an immense impression in his favor on the mind of his fellow townsmen. The arrivals increase in number, and the heat and noise increase in very unpleasant proportion. The livery servants form a complete lane on either side of the passage, and you reduce yourself into the smallest possible space, to avoid being turned out. You see that stout man with the hoarse voice, in the blue coat, queer-crowned, broad-brimmed hat, white corduroy breeches, and great boots, who has been talking incessantly for half an hour past, and whose importance has occasioned no small quantity of mirth among the strangers. That is the great conservator of the peace of Westminster. You cannot fail to have remarked the grace with which he saluted the noble lord who passed just now, or the excessive dignity of his air, as he expostulates with the crowd. He is rather out of temper now, in consequence of the very irreverent behavior of those two young fellows behind him, who have done nothing but laugh all the time they have been here. Will they divide tonight, do you think? Mr. Timidly inquires a little thin man in the crowd, hoping to conciliate the man of office. How can you ask such questions, sir? Replies the functionary, in an incredibly loud key, and pettishly grasping the thick stick he carries in his right hand. Pray do not, sir. I beg of you, pray do not, sir. The little man looks remarkably out of his element, and the uninitiated part of the throng are in positive convulsions of laughter. Just at this moment some unfortunate individual appears, with a very smirking air, at the bottom of the long passage. He has managed to elude the vigilance of the special constable downstairs, and is evidently congratulating himself on having made his way so far. Go back, sir, you must not come here, shouts the hoarse one, with tremendous emphasis of voice and gesture, the moment the offender catches his eye. The stranger pauses. Do you hear, sir, will you go back? Continues the official dignitary, gently pushing the intruder some half dozen yards. Come, don't push me, apostrophe replies the stranger, turning angrily round. I will, sir. Apostrophe, you won't, sir. Apostrophe, go out, sir. Apostrophe, take your hands off me, sir. Apostrophe, go out of the passage, sir. Apostrophe, you're a jack in office, sir. Apostrophe, a what? Apostrophe, apostrophe, ejaculates he of the boots. A jack in office, sir, and a very insolent fellow, apostrophe reiterates the stranger, now completely in a passion. Pray do not force me to put you out, sir, apostrophe retorts the other. Pray do not, my instructions are to keep this passage clear. It's the speaker's orders, sir. Apostrophe, DN the speaker, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, shouts the intruder. Here, Wilson. Collins. Apostrophe, gasps the officer, actually paralyzed at this insulting expression, which in his mind is all but high treason. Take this man out, take him out, I say. How dare you, sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, and down goes the unfortunate man five stairs at a time, turning round at every stoppage, to come back again, and denouncing bitter vengeance against the commander-in-chief, and all his supernumeraries. Make way, gentlemen, pray make way for the members, I beg of you. Apostrophe, apostrophe, shouts the zealous officer, turning back, and preceding a whole string of the liberal and independent. You see this ferocious-looking gentleman, with a complexion almost as sallow as his linen, and whose large black mustache would give him the appearance of a figure in a hairdresser's window, if his countenance possessed the thought which is communicated to those waxen caricatures of the human face divine. He is a militia officer, and the most amusing person in the house. Can anything be more exquisitely absurd than the burlesque grandeur of his air, as he strides up to the lobby, his eyes rolling like those of a Turk's head in a cheap Dutch clock? He never appears without that bundle of dirty papers which he carries under his left arm, and which are generally supposed to be the miscellaneous estimates for 1804 or some equally important documents. He is very punctual in his attendance at the house, and his self-satisfied apostrophe is not unfrequently the signal for a general titter. This is the gentleman who once actually sent a messenger up to the stranger's gallery in the old House of Commons, to inquire the name of an individual who was using an eyeglass, in order that he might complain to the speaker that the person in question was quizzing him. On another occasion, he is reported to have repaired to Bellamy's kitchen, a refreshment room, where persons who are not members are admitted on sufferance, as it were, and perceiving two or three gentlemen at supper, who, he was aware, were not members, and could not, in that place, very well resent his behavior, he indulged in the pleasantry of sitting with his booted leg on the table at which they were supping. He is generally harmless, though, and always amusing. By dint of patience, and some little interest with our friend the constable, we have contrived to make our way to the lobby, and you can just manage to catch an occasional glimpse of the house, as the door is opened for the admission of members. It is tolerably full already, and little groups of members are congregated together here, discussing the interesting topics of the day. That smart-looking fellow in the black coat with velvet facings and cuffs, who wears his D'Orsay hat so rakishly, is Honest Tom, apostrophe a metropolitan representative, and the large man in the cloak with the white lining, not the man by the pillar, the other with the light hair hanging over his coat collar behind, is his colleague. The quiet, gentlemanly-looking man in the blue shirt out, gray trousers, white neckerchief and gloves, whose closely buttoned coat displays his manly figure and broad chest to great advantage, is a very well-known character. He has fought a great many battles in his time, and conquered like the heroes of old, with no other arms than those the gods gave him. The old hard-featured man who is standing near him is really a good specimen of a class of men, now nearly extinct. He is a county member, and has been from time whereof the memory of man is not to the contrary. Look at his loose, wide, brown coat, with capacious pockets on each side, the knee breeches and boots, the immensely long waistcoat, and silver watch chain dangling below it, the wide-brimmed brown hat, and the white handkerchief tied in a great bow, with straggling ends sticking out beyond his shirt frill. It is a costume one seldom sees nowadays, and when the few who wear it have died off, it will be quite extinct. He can tell you long stories of Fox, Pitt, Sheridan, and Canning, and how much better the House was managed in those times, when they used to get up at 8 or 9 o'clock, except on regular field days, of which everybody was apprised beforehand. He has a great contempt for all young members of Parliament, and thinks it quite impossible that a man can say anything worth hearing, unless he has sat in the House for 15 years at least, without saying anything at all. He is of opinion that young Macaulay was a regular impostor. He allows that Lord Stanley may do something one of these days, but he's too young, sir, too young. Apostrophe, he is an excellent authority on points of precedent, and when he grows talkative, after his wine, will tell you how Sir Somebody Something, when he was whippering for the government, brought 4 men out of their beds, 2 vote in the majority, 3 of whom died on their way home again, how the House once divided on the question, that fresh candles be now brought in. How the Speaker was once upon a time left in the chair by accident, at the conclusion of business, and was obliged to sit in the House by himself for 3 hours, till some member could be knocked up and brought back again, to move the adjournment, and a great many other anecdotes of a similar description. There he stands, leaning on his stick, looking at the throng of exquisites around him with most profound contempt, and conjuring up, before his mind's eye, the scenes he beheld in the old House, in days gone by, when his own feelings were fresher and brighter, and when, as he imagines, wit, talent, and patriotism flourished more brightly too. You are curious to know who that young man in the rough greatcoat is, who has accosted every member who has entered the House, since we have been standing here. He is not a member. He is only an hereditary bondsman, apostrophe, or, in other words, an Irish correspondent of an Irish newspaper, who has just procured his 42nd franc from a member whom he never saw in his life before. There he goes again, another. Bless the man, he has his hat and pockets full already. We will try our fortune at the Strangers' Gallery, though the nature of the debate encourages very little hope of success. What on earth are you about? Holding up your order, as if it were a talisman at whose command the wicket would fly open? Nonsense. Just preserve the order for an autograph, if it be worth keeping at all, and make your appearance at the door with your thumb and forefinger expressively inserted in your waistcoat pocket. This tall stout man in black is the doorkeeper. Any room? Apostrophe, not an inch, 2 or 3 dozen gentlemen waiting downstairs on the chance of somebody's going out. Apostrophe, pull out your purse, are you quite sure there's no room? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I'll go and look, apostrophe, replies the doorkeeper, with a wistful glance at your purse, but I'm afraid there's not. Apostrophe, he returns, and with real feeling, assures you that it is morally impossible to get near the gallery. It is of no use waiting. When you are refused admission into the Strangers' Gallery at the House of Commons, under such circumstances, you may return home thoroughly satisfied that the place must be remarkably full indeed. 1. Retracing our steps through the long passage, descending the stairs, and crossing Palace Yard, we halt at a small temporary doorway adjoining the King's entrance to the House of Lords. The order of the sergeant-at-arms will admit you into the reporter's gallery, from whence you can obtain a tolerably good view of the House. Take care of the stairs, they are none of the best, through this little wicket there. As soon as your eyes become a little used to the mist of the place, and the glare of the chandeliers below you, you will see that some unimportant personage on the ministerial side of the House, to your right hand, is speaking, amidst a hum of voices and confusion which would rival Babel, but for the circumstance of its being all in one language. The hear, apostrophe which occasions that laugh, proceeded from our warlike friend with the mustache. He is sitting on the back seat against the wall, behind the member who is speaking, looking as ferocious and intellectual as usual. Take one look around you, and retire. The body of the house and the side galleries are full of members, some with their legs on the back of the opposite seat, some with theirs stretched out to their utmost length on the floor, some going out, others coming in, all talking, laughing, lounging, coughing, owing, questioning, or groaning, presenting a conglomeration of noise and confusion, to be met within no other place in existence, not even excepting Smithfield on a market day, or a cockpit in its glory. But let us not omit to notice Bellamy's kitchen, or, in other words, the refreshment room, common to both houses of Parliament, where ministerialists and oppositionists, Whigs and Tories, radicals, peers and destructives, strangers from the gallery and the more favored strangers from below the bar, are alike at liberty to resort, where divers honorable members prove their perfect independence, by remaining during the whole of a heavy debate, solacing themselves with the creature comforts, and whence they are summoned by whippers in, when the house is on the point of dividing, either to give their conscientious votes on questions, of which they are conscientiously innocent of knowing anything whatever, or to find a vent for the playful exuberance of their wine-inspired fancies, in boisterous shouts of divide, apostrophe occasionally varied with a little howling, barking, crowing, or other ebullitions of senatorial pleasantry. When you have ascended the narrow staircase which, in the present temporary House of Commons, leads to the place we are describing, you will probably observe a couple of rooms on your right hand, with tables spread for dining. Neither of these is the kitchen, although they are both devoted to the same purpose. The kitchen is further on to our left, up these half dozen stairs. Before we ascend the staircase, however, we must request you to pause in front of this little bar place with the sash windows, and beg your particular attention to the steady, honest-looking old fellow in black, who is its sole occupant. Nicholas, we do not mind mentioning the old fellow's name, for if Nicholas be not a public man, who is? And public men's names are public property. Nicholas is the butler of Bellamy's, and has held the same place, dressed exactly in the same manner, and said precisely the same things, ever since the oldest of its present visitors can remember. An excellent servant, Nicholas is an unrivaled compounder of salad dressing, an admirable preparer of soda water and lemon, a special mixer of cold grog and punch, and, above all, an unequaled judge of cheese. If the old man have such a thing as vanity in his composition, this is certainly his pride. And if it be possible to imagine that anything in this world could disturb his impenetrable calmness, we should say it would be the doubting his judgment on this important point. We needn't tell you all this, however, for if you have an atom of observation, one glance at his sleek, knowing-looking head and face, his prim white neckerchief, with the wooden tie into which it has been regularly folded for 20 years past, merging by imperceptible degrees into a small plaited shirt frill, and his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.